Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
I need to mention to you, I know there's so much going in our lives today and so many things happening. But folks, my kind of Bible study is such that you just come and hearing it one time is not going to mean that much to you. It needs to be read and studied somewhat before I get a hold of it with you. And to maximize our time together, I hope you read in several translations the psalm we're going to do and look at least in one commentary. If you haven't bought a commentary on the Psalms, I'll be in the Psalms through Psalm 72 before I go back to the book of Joshua. And if you haven't bought a commentary, the little commentary, the Tyndale commentary in the Old Testament on Psalms, 1 through 72 and 73 through 150 is excellent. And I hope you'll do that. I really do. Let me get you to read Psalm 65 in your translation, and I'll give you 2 minutes or so to do that. And as you go through, notice how rapidly the subject matter changes. Okay? Psalm 65. Really is. It's still a psalm of David. If I were to ask you right from the beginning, what season of the year, what particular time or occasion do you think this psalm possibly might be written to? Okay? Boy, I think so. Either right before the growing season, trusting in God for the rain, or right after the harvest, thanking God and trusting for the next year. This seems to me like a harvest kind of prayer song. And yet notice, think about this. Though the focus is harvest and crops and the abundance of God's material blessings as far as produce of the land, notice that the produce of the land is related to man's spiritual condition. Think about that. Now, we're not all farmers today, but I want to tell you what. There is a nerve that connects our spiritual condition before God with everything that we do and the productivity thereof. Now, let's go through the 1 through 4 deals basically with the spiritual relationship between these worshipers and the Lord. And the Hebrew is extremely difficult in verses 1 through 3. Now, not difficult because the text is in bad shape, but difficult because we don't know how to translate some of the words. And so let me give you some examples. Look at your translation, please, in verse 1. Mine has, New American Standard, there will be silence before thee and praise in Zion, O God. Now, yours is different if you have a different translation. Let me just show you some of the differentness, if I could, in some of the translations that I look at when I study. The Hebrew text very specifically says, to you silence, no verb, praise. That's the Hebrew. We assume the verb is. Many assume other verbs, but that's what it says in Hebrew. To you silence, praise. That's tough. The Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, has praise becomes thee. The Peshitta, which is the Aramaic translation the Old Testament has, praise is befitting thee. The American Standard Version, praise waiteth for thee. The New Jerusalem Bible, praise is rightfully yours. Now, with that many translations, what does that tell us right off? Bingo. When you got 8 translations, 8 different ways of putting it, what does that mean? There's problems in the text. Now, all these men were searching for the Lord's will, all these committees, to be the best way to communicate the Hebrew text to people, to English people. And every one of them are different. Now, that tells you right off the bat, either the text is difficult or the words are not translatable, at least without doubt. And that's what we have here. The word that silence is the word that's very hard to fit in translations. Some say that silence praise is a compound hyphened word. That's an assumption, but I think that's very good, that silence praise. Now, where else in the Bible have we heard something about silence being a form of praise, or silence something that God desires from His people? Remember offhand? Remember Psalms 46:10? I preached on it Sunday, but I didn't get down to verse 10. It says, relax, or be still, or quiet, exclamation point, and know that I am God. Also in Psalms 62, verses 1 and 5, it says, be still before the Lord. There is a sense in which quietness is worship. Now, notice the... it says in Zion. Now, in Zion is a reference to the city of Jerusalem, in particular, the presence of God. It, not in the temple, because this is David. Temple did not exist in David's day. What existed? In David's day, what expression of the presence of God was there? The tabernacle, the tent, was still in David's day. Now, notice where it says, the second part of verse 1, which you, I think, got to relate together, is, and to thee the vow will be performed. Two thoughts run in my mind here. God keeps His word to you. God expects you to keep your word to Him. I remember I had such a time quitting smoking. Oh, my soul. I can know what that guy in the hospital is going through. I really had a hard time. I quit one time for a year and started again and quit. And, oh, it was off and on, off and on. Finally, the only way I quit was I was reading the Old Testament one night. And I said, you know, these guys brought the best of their cattle and sacrificed the best of their sheep, the best of their produce, and offered it as a burnt offering. I thought about burning my car, but I wasn't sure the Lord would take it. Back then, the kind of car I was driving, so I thought, how could I show the Lord that I was serious about really loving Him? What could I do? And I thought, I'm going to give Him my smoking, something I enjoy and don't feel guilty about particularly, but I'm going to give it to Him as an expression of how much I love Him. Now, you know, after that, I was afraid to take them back. But it was terribly difficult, even with that kind of commitment, you know. I remember I found a verse in Psalms, or in Proverbs, that said, if you vow a vow, pay it. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who vows a vow and does not pay it. Well, now, it didn't say I had to do it, but since I dummy did it, I had to keep it. Now, I think here it may be saying the very same kind of words. When I say something to you, I mean it, God says. And I trust that when you talk to me, you mean it too. Or another insight might be, could it be we have two kinds of prayer here? Silent prayer in 1A and vocal prayer in 1B, and God hears both? Could it be two kinds or forms of prayer, one silent, one vocal? I think there's a real possibility in that. And notice verse 2 is a course tied with verse 1, when it says, O thou who dost hear prayer. Now, the Hebrew word begins with the participle hearing. It is really a title for God. Now, we think about calling God God, or the living God, or, you know, so many titles we call Him. But this is really another title for God. And the title is, O thou who ever hears prayers. Now, that's not a phrase. That's a title for the characteristic way that God deals with man. There has never been anybody who prayed in sincerity to God that God did not hear. He reads the silent thoughts of our heart, and He reads the fruit of our lips. And the New Testament tells us that even when we don't know how to pray, the Holy Spirit, Romans 8, 26, 27, prays for us in exactly what we need. God prays to Himself for us and through us and in us. Isn't that amazing? Now, notice the second verse. For I, the second, you know that the verse 1, 2, 3, and 4 are not in the original text. That was put in much, much later. I don't think the second part of verse 2 should go with verse 2. The second part should go with verse 3. Because thou who hearest prayer, I think it's not so much related as to thee all men come as it is to the idea of coming to thee with our iniquities. But notice what it says. To thee all men, I would add, may come, because I think it's very important that all men don't come, but all men can come. Now here again is somewhat of a problem over the words, for the New Jerusalem Bible has come with all his or her sins. The New English Bible has all men lay their guilt before thee. Now you see, both those translations are picking up on what? The next verse, aren't they? They're not picking up on two, they're picking up on three. Because three says, iniquities prevail against me. Now here again, we've got a problem in how to translate it. The word iniquities in Hebrew is really the words of iniquities, which would be understood by a Hebrew person, things of iniquity. Now the question is, whose iniquity? Is someone speaking evil against me that I can't handle? Or is it my own words of iniquity and acts of iniquity that I can't handle? Now there's the problem, and we don't know which it is. Listen to all these different translations for a moment. The Hebrew simply has, words of iniquity are mightier than I. The Septuagint and the Peshitta have, the words of the wicked have prevailed against me. The New Jerusalem Bible has, though our faults overpower us. Now you see how they're getting two things? One of them is the words of the wicked. That's the Peshitta and the Septuagint. And the other one's my evil is overcoming me. You say, well, Bob, which is it? There's no way to know. It's just not clear enough. It's too ambiguous to say dogmatically which it is. Personally, the flavor of the psalm is not God, people are after me. That's what's been the flavor of the last 10. The flavor of the psalm is, I pray to you, you hear me, O God, I think cleanse my iniquities, not stop their mouths, but stop my mouth. My mouth's the problem. My deeds are the problem. My hands are the problem. Now, notice the beauty of this all men is, now think with me, all men can come to God for forgiveness, if only they would. Now, what's so shocking about that? What, that's something, a red light ought to go off in your Old Testament Hebraic mind. What's so shocking about all men can come to God for forgiveness? We have just burst the bounds of the covenant. We have just walked over the barrier of Israel and we have walked into all the world. We have just left the favored nation status of Israel and we have said across the board, God will forgive the sins of any who come to Him. Now friends, that is a universal element that is very, very beautiful and in a sense very, very radical in the Old Testament. The only other places besides the Psalms that it is so prominent is what prophet is known as the universal prophet? Isaiah. Okay, the universal element here of all men. And it doesn't stop there. The same ideal is picked up a little lower down there in verse 5, but I'll get to that in a moment. Now notice where it says, iniquities prevail against me, overpower me. As for our transgression, thou dost forgive them. The word forgive here is the verb kippur. Where have you heard kippur before? Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16. It is a Hebrew word that means covering. It's used a whole lot in Leviticus and Numbers, okay? It's the idea of the high priest coming into the Holy of Holies with the blood of the sacrificial animals, sprinkling it on that mercy seat between the cherubim, and the blood of those innocent animals covers the sin from the sight of God who symbolically dwells above the wings of the cherubim. And so it's the aspect of covering by means of sacrificial blood. We've heard that before, haven't we? That's the New Testament concept of what Jesus Christ has done. Brought His own blood into the Holy of Holies in heaven. Now, notice, if you would, where it speaks about how blessed is the one whom thou dost choose and bring near to thee to dwell in thy courts. Now, notice that again, we can't prove it here, but because we were in the universal element in the verse before, it almost could be implied, not reading too much here, that we're still out to the ends of the earth and not back to Israel only, although we are back to some cultic terms. Okay? What theological statement would do you think, knowing me, that I would draw from the fact that thou dost choose? What do I say over and over again about the... Does man choose God? Does man desire to be saved? Does man come to God? This is the doctrine of the sovereignty and the choosing and the predestination, and to put it the way I usually do, God always takes the initiative. God always draws man. New Testament-wise, that would be John 6:44, John 6:65. No one comes unto the Father unless the Spirit woos him. No man chooses the time or the day or the month or the hour when the Spirit of God draws him. That's why when your heart is touched by God, you need to respond then. Okay, God chooses. God always takes initiative. It's not man coming to God. It's God always coming to man. Has that thought ever hit you? Friend, God was on your trail. You didn't get real good, nice, friendly, and lovey, and God say, hey, you wouldn't be half bad in my family. When you were stinking, rebellious, away, filthy, God said, I want you, and I'm going to stay on your trail until you come to know me. And that is overwhelming. And bring near to thee. Now, the word bring near is the cultic term. It's used over and over again in the books Leviticus, the book of Numbers. And it is a word that is specific for the fact of someone drawing near to God by bringing a sacrifice or by a priest coming near or by someone being anointed. It's a phrase that speaks of getting near to God by going through the sacrificial system of Israel. Now, I could think about some New Testament things where it talks about in heroes that come boldly to his throne of grace as a new way. But notice here, the two things I want to emphasize is God chooses us, God brings us near, and look at the next one. He causes us to dwell in his courts, to live in his courts. The word dwell means to live with. Do you catch the unbelievable statement that God wants you to live with him? We talk so often in the church about personal relationships. And I think sometimes we do not understand what that means because we don't have a personal relationship with God as we have with someone that we talk to and see and touch and, you know, and yet we do. For when you pray to him, do not you pray to him as a person? Do you not expect him to answer you in ways that you can understand? A personal relationship with God says that we believe God is a person who wants to respond to us as a person, and we have to respond to him by faith. And look how God reciprocates. He chooses us, he draws us near to him, and he says, come live with me. God doesn't want to keep you in a shack out back until you get cleaned up. God says, hey, fella, hey, lady, I want you to come and stay where I stay. Now that, to me, is a beautiful promise of what eternity is going to be like. God's not going to stick us off to some planet and say, I'll see you every 10,000 years. God says, hey, why don't y'all stay here around the throne? Let's see what's happening together. Family, the personal deal. Now, here also in verse 4, the last part, is a very good definition of something we need to continue to think about. Now, in the 23rd Psalm, verse 6, it said, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And how many times have I heard that made heaven? Have you? I may have done it. But this verse shows us that when the house of the Lord is used, it is referring to something else. What? What's the house of the Lord referring to? Tabernacle. So when the Old Testament in David 2 is speaking about dwelling in the house of the Lord, there's a sense in which he's saying, I want to be in the place where I can worship you. Now there's more involved here because you don't stay in the temple forever. You've got to eat, right? And surely when you die, you're not buried in the temple grounds. So there's more to that. But the basic definition of the term the house of God for the Old Testament is the tabernacle. That's what I'm saying. This is a definitive definition of the word the house in the Psalms. Now, you say, well, that means that we've got to be in Jerusalem. We've got to be, Israeli. We've got to be there. I want you to lock in with me on these cultic terms. In Zion, in the house of the Lord, in the holy temple, draw near being a cultic term. And I want you to hold that for a minute and realize that the next verse, the first four is emphasized a spiritual relationship with God, although universal in Israel. The next verse is going to emphasize a spiritual relationship with God, but around the world. Now that is
Friends, this is something radical. In Judaism, in David's day, to say that all men can come and all men everywhere can come and God is with them. Now that is just, we're breaking new ground here theologically for the Jewish mind. Okay, look at the 5 through 8 now. By awesome deeds thou dost answer us in righteousness, O God of our salvation. Now again, very difficult to understand what the Hebrew word awful means. Now, in American Standard Version, it's called terrible things. In New Jerusalem, it's called marvelous things. Now, what is it? Is it terrible or is it marvelous? Is it wonderful or is it frightful? Well, that's the question. But I say to you, some other ways this word is used in the Old Testament tells me that this is not marvelous, wonderful, exciting. It's terrible, awesome, fearful is what it should be. Matter of fact, Genesis 28:17 is where Jacob met God at Bethel when he woke up, had the dream about the angels coming out of heaven up and down the ladder. And when he woke up, he didn't say, oh, what a wonderful place. He said, oh, my soul, this is God's house. And what am I doing here? This is an awesome place, a frightful, scary place. I shouldn't even be here. Also, in Exodus 15:11, it talks about the deeds of God bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt, the plagues. Those were marvelous, wonderful things. That night the death angel came was absolutely terrifying. Not wonderful and marvelous. Scare your pants off night, you know. So what does it mean when it says, by terrible, awesome, frightful, thou dost answer in righteousness? What does that mean? It means when God acts, either in deliverance like Exodus or in judgment, even though you're not involved, when you see the hand of God moving in our world in specific ways, it is a frightening experience. You know, this idea about granddaddy upstairs and the old man, ooh, I shiver. I have just never gotten over the fact that God is God and God is different and He is holy and He is other and He bids me come, but even when I come, there is an awesomeness that penetrates me, right? Even to stand before His presence clothed in the righteousness of Christ, I'm afraid I stand there with great boldness, but with knees shaking, for I am in the presence of the Almighty, the Creator, the ever-living One. And I think there's something awesome and terrible about that to man. Notice, O God, our refuge, another title. Just like the one who ever hears. O God, our salvation. Is it physical salvation like it usually is in the Old Testament? Or is it spiritual salvation? Which is it here, if you had to make a choice? Well, this is not an either-or question. It's a both-and. It's obviously spiritual because of verses 1 through 4, is it not? It's obviously, in a real sense, physical because of verses 5 through 8. So was the word salvation mean spiritual or physical? Yes. Yes. Now, notice, if you would, where it says in the last part of verse 5, thou who art the trust of all, the ends of the earth and the farthest sea. Is that a particular statement or a universal statement? Is Israel or just the world? It's the world. We've hit this absolutely unique universal spectrum. Thou who art the confidence or the trust of all the ends of the earth, not just Jerusalem or not just the scattered Jews, but every creature on the earth. Now, to us, the farthest sea doesn't really say a whole lot to us. But remember, first of all, we have the contrast between being in Zion and loving God, right? That's verses 1 through 4. And now where are we? We're in the farthest end of the world, to the farthest sea, to the farthest island, and we're still worshiping God. So we have a geographical antithesis between Israel and Zion and anywhere you want to trust Him, right? But also, you've got to remember, now, traveling by boat is not a terribly frightening thing today. We don't think about anything about getting on a big ocean liner or going across the ocean. If you had the money, I guess, and the time, you wouldn't think anything about it. You might have watched the Titanic movie and been a little nervous, but, you know, usually it's not a frightening experience. Can you imagine what it was like to try to cross the seas with the equipment they had in David's day? No compass, sails, reed boats, some kind of wooden ships, but not very big. Now, friends, when he says that God is to the farthest sea, he is making a radical statement that an English reader misses. When you say that God is the God that you can trust in to the farthest sea, you have just made a statement that would have slapped the ancient Jew right in the face. First of all, the Jews did not like to be on the sea. The Philistines, fine, let them go out there. You know, the Jew just wasn't your normal sailor type. Jonah proved that, right? No. Jews weren't known for their big sailing industries. Now, Solomon had some ships, but probably he hired Phoenicians to do it. So that is the ultimate statement of trust to a Jewish person. Friends, you live in a desert place most of your life. You get out in the middle of Sea of Galilee, you're afraid, much less out in the Mediterranean or out in the Indian Ocean. So this is a way of saying the supreme confidence of trust in God on the ocean. Notice, if you would, when it mentions here, thou hast established the mountains, being girded with might, the seas roar, the waters foam. And look at the last part of verse 7. Here again is a definition we need to pick up on. Many times in the Bible, the term seas or waters is used as a metaphor of peoples or nations. And here is a definitive passage. Okay? Another one might be Jeremiah 51:25. And so I think the seas as people here is extremely important. I also want you to know, God's the one who found the mountains. God's the one who controls the seas. Here is a statement on God as creator and controller of things and people. A little song that says, all things are in his hands. That means the mountains, the seas, the bushes, the little baby, the birds, you and me. God is the sustainer and provider because God is the creator of all that is. All right, notice in verse 8 where it says, and they who dwell on the ends of the earth stand in awe. It's the same verb used up there in verse 5. In awe of thy signs or terrible deeds. Notice again the universal element, which is, really, we get so used to it in the New Testament, we don't realize the bang radicalness for a Jew to read this. He'd say, you mean those people God loves? Them? Yes, David would say. Yes. To the ends of the earth they stand in awe. And thou dost make the dawn and the sunset. This is a Hebrew word, outgoing of the morning and ingoing. It speaks of the rising of the sun, the setting of the sun. And what it's saying is, from the rising of the sun to the setting of the sun, all people shout for joy before the God that is in Zion. Universal. From the far as the east is from the west, everybody in between shouts for joy about God, the God of Israel, the God of Hebrews. Now, notice if you would where, let's see, verse 9 through 13, I don't want to mention a whole lot. It's agricultural. It's obviously God taking an active part in his world to assure the crops and sustenance of his people and all peoples. Notice a bit about water. The stream of God is full of water, waters in the furrows abundantly. It settles the ridges. That means the rain knocks down the furrows. It's so hard. Implication being a real gully washer, you know. Choke the frogs. Softens it with showers. And notice the number of times the word water is mentioned here. Now, I know that a lot of times water is synonymous with the Holy Spirit in the Bible, but I just don't see it here at all. I think I'm reading much, much, much too into it from a theological presupposition than we are from the text. It's not talking about the Holy Spirit. This is talking about God's bountiful response to nature. It's kind of like Malachi saying the windows of heaven will be opened and the blessings will come out. Well, one of the blessings for a semi-arid land is rain. Rain is the blessing of God. It's more precious than gold, you see. Now, what it's saying is God causes the rains. He also causes the sands. God is not nature. God is the controller of nature. God is not synonymous with nature. God is the creator of nature. We need to remember that, because many people think that God and nature are one. Notice again verse 11, almost a summary verse of this passage, where it says, "Thou dost crown the year with thy bounty or goodness, and thy paths drip with fatness." The word paths is the word for a field wagon. It's almost the picture of God riding his own harvest wagon across the world. And as God rides his harvest wagon across the world, the fatness of the land, the fruit of the land, drip from the wheels and the back of the wagon. That's a beautiful metaphor about God's personal care of people and God's special care of those who have a spiritual relationship with him, Israel or whoever will. Now notice also the pastures, the wilderness, the hills, the meadows, the valleys in verses 12 and 13. This is the uncultivated land. The picture here is of the valleys and hills and mountains putting on robes. Robes of cattle, robes of fields of flowers, robes of luxurious green grass. You ever seen a field of wild flowers and just be awestruck by the beauty of it? You ever seen cattle on the side of a beautiful green hill and just be struck with the bounty of the land? Here is the land putting on his robes, these beautiful blessings. And notice that this is done completely by God himself, because nobody's cultivating these things. King James has, I think, the pastures, the hills gird themselves with, the meadows are clothed with flocks. Doesn't it have the flocks or with lambs? Something like that. Huh? Flocks or with lambs? Verse 13. Okay, it must be a different translation. One of those, the word for meadow and the word for baby lambs. Some translations have it. Jump between that. Notice the last verse. They shout for joy. Yes, they sing. Now, I want to tell you, I want to close with this. I've got 5 minutes. Good, I don't have time for questions. This is a picture almost like Isaiah 11 of an earth to which the curse has been removed. An earth that drips with the bounty that God always intended it for have. An earth that is rich and fruitful and productive. An earth not touched by the sin of man. And in Romans 8, 19 through 22, it says the earth groans in itself for the revealing of the sons of God. My personal theology says not so much that we're going to heaven when this is all over, but that heaven is coming back to us on recreated earth. New Jerusalem is coming down out of heaven as a bride adorned for a husband. God, the tabernacle of God, is again with man, Revelation 22. And the earth, the new earth, the new created earth, will have richness and blessing and productivity like you can't imagine. And that's almost the picture here as Isaiah 11 is of that coming day of the Lord. And it speaks of the removal of the curse and God with his people. It's almost the picture of when we were in Israel, Bill and I got to go to a harvest festival in the Jewish kibbutz. A great time for them. They had all the kids out and they brought all the produce and showed them how big the watermelons were. Well, it wasn't watermelons, it was pumpkins, wasn't it, or something? Jewish eating watermelons, I guess, a little too much, even for y'all to believe. But anyway, bringing all the produce out, can't you get a picture of that great day with the Lord when he drives, and this is all anthropomorphic, I'm not saying God literally going to drive, but just think of the picture. Drives in the wild wagon of bounty with all the fruits of the land and all of God's children rejoicing in God being with them and what the land has produced. Beautiful picture of the personal involvement of God with his people and the personal blessings that come from being right spiritually with God and the ultimate promise of one day. One day. Okay. Questions or comments? Quite different psalm, wasn't it? From God, get them, they're after me. Smash them again for your sake and mine too. Just radically different, I tell you. Radically different. Well, I hope the next few are going to be like that, a little different. It'll get longer, I know. Questions or comments? Yes, Terry. All flesh, right. My translation puts all men. That's the inference. The word is flesh. It's the same word that's used for animals in Genesis 2. So, it almost could be everybody can come to me, everything can come to me, and yet that since the next verse talks about iniquities, I eliminate the animals and just make it men. But I do make it men and not Jews, because I think, boy, it's a beautiful universal thing here. It's staggering.